This is John Steinman of Deconstructing Dinner, and you're tuned in to CKDU 88.1 FM, Halifax.
And you're listening to Operation Wake Up for Monday, October 19th. My name is Jesse McNichol, and following with this week's theme of climate change, leading up to an International Day of Action on Saturday, October 24th, today's show is about food and its many connections to the climate crisis. The voice you just heard, of CJLY's John Steinman, may be familiar to you as the host of the insightful syndicated radio show Deconstructing Dinner, which airs on CKTU every Sunday from 9 to 10 a.m. Dalhousie University was fortunate to host John on November 1st for a talk on how local food can bring together and strengthen a community in pursuit of a common goal. Mr. Steinman's talk covered not only the topic of corporate control of agriculture, but also what people in his native Nelson, British Columbia, are doing to reverse this trend to create a more environmentally friendly food culture. What follows is an edited version of that talk, as well as interviews of local organizations dedicated to food issues in Nova Scotia. And now to start things off, let's hear John Steinman talk about the changing face of food in the 21st century.
When it comes to food, we know that today the production of our food faces many challenges. It faces challenges on all levels, whether it's industrially produced food on a global scale or whether it's small-scale production. One of the experiences I've had in speaking with farmers of all sizes, not the farmers themselves, but the size of the land, is that they all face similar challenges. And for the most part, a farmer who is farming on 2,000 acres, 3,000 acres, or just a few acres, as I've come to believe, and I know some would disagree, I don't believe that we can sustain many of the methods of food production that we are trying to sustain today. And so as it applies to our communities, which is somewhat of the focus of my presentation, as it applies to our communities or our cities as larger communities, that places most of us in a pretty vulnerable position if this is indeed the case, that our food system cannot be sustained as it is right now. So the title of my presentation is Resilient Food Secure Communities. And what I mean by resilience is the resilience to be able to weather very significant economic changes and very significant environmental changes, among other concerns. And what I believe is that communities and cities cannot be resilient without being food secure. The way I look at food security, and the way most of us in the local food movement look at food security, is with this definition here: that a food secure community is one in which all people at all times have access to nutritious, safe, personally appropriate, and culturally acceptable food produced, procured, and distributed in ways that are socially and environmentally responsible. And so we, of course, should be asking ourselves, well, are we food secure? Are we able to access nutritious food? Are we able to access food that's procured and distributed in ways that are socially and environmentally responsible? That the latter two there, the socially and environmentally responsible side of food, is hard to know. We don't see too many labels on the food when we walk into grocery stores or into restaurants. As far as nutrition goes, well, there's many messages that we're bombarded with. It appears that we have nutritious food in light of all those messages. It appears we have safe food. Most of the grocery stores we walk into are pretty clean. The packages are pretty clean. It appears we have safe food, at least on the grocery store shelves. So it appears we're food secure. We walk into the grocery stores, there's food all over the shelves. Seems we have plenty of food. But I think when we start to ask ourselves, well, what's the impact of those food choices? When we purchase that food, what's the impact on the environment, on our health, on our communities? And we start to ask those questions and seek some answers, we end up, I believe, discovering that we're not very food secure at all. And the food security that appears to be on those grocery store shelves is in fact an illusion. This is what I suggest. Some of you may be familiar with the book Diet for a Small Planet. That was authored in 1971 by Francis Moore LePay. And this was probably one of the first books that started to look behind the scenes as to where our food's coming from and what the impacts our food choices are having. In particular, livestock production is what she focused on. And she said, the work of hope means peeling away the layers of causation until we can actually see a pattern and then know that our actions are interrupting the downward spiral that is pulling us into more and more hunger and deprivation. And that's really what Deconstructing Dinner tries to do. When we start to peel the layers away, we come upon, I believe, six concerns. Environmental concerns as it applies to our food, economic concerns, corporate concentration within our food system, health, food safety, cultural, and social concerns. We look at our food purchases as an expense. We look at them as a cost. You know, we walk into a restaurant and walk out and think, well, that meal cost me $40. Or we walk into a bakery and we think, well, that loaf of bread cost me $4. It's an expense. We're spending money. And I'd like you to consider that instead of interacting with our food that way as a cost, that we instead look at our food as an investment, that we are investing not only in our food, but all of these various areas of concern as well, following those food purchases. And I think when we start to do this, we look at our food purchases as investments, there can be a substantial shift in how we interact with the food and what we end up choosing to purchase and choosing to support. And so we need to ask ourselves, okay, well, what are we investing in when we go through the grocery store checkout counter or pay for our restaurant meal? What are we investing in? And what I've come to believe in the few years now I've been doing this show and the 10 years that I've been involved in this subject of food since I started doing this at the University of Guelph, engaging in this subject, I believe we have very few options. And for the most part, when we're investing our money at a grocery store or at a restaurant, we're investing in most often one model of a food system, which is an industrial food system. Just as any smart investor would do, we need to be asking ourselves, well, how secure is our investment in this case, this industrial food system that most of us have really very little choice but to support? Is our investment secure? The short answer to that, I would say, is no. It is not secure to just rely on this one model that we're investing in. And so this activity that I'd like to just engage in just a moment here is one in which we can deconstruct a meal. And before I do that, I'd like to maybe just get a show of hands. How many of you have heard of the company Cargill? Okay, so maybe about 10% of you. So now that should come as a surprise, because Cargill is one of the, if not the largest, agricultural corporation in the world. And I'm going to put up a standard North American meal here that we can deconstruct and learn a little more about this company. So this is the type of meal that most of us would consume. Maybe not a steak that looks as good as that, but certainly a meat product, typically beef, bread, French fries, a salad, a mug of beer, if not beer, maybe a soft drink, chocolate ice cream, and a glass of water. This is a standard North American meal. So Cargill has been around since 1865. It's one of the largest privately held companies in the world, which is one of the reasons we don't hear a lot about it, because it's not publicly traded on any stock exchange.
John went on to talk about the many connections to Cargill that the average North American meal would have. There's a good chance that everything from the beer or soft drinks to the wheat and salt or vegetable oil would have come from this one company that controls such a large market share. John went on to talk about how this concentration of wealth has an effect on local economies and the livelihoods of farmers across Canada.
In the case of the beef, well, Cargill controls 40% of all of the beef slaughtered, processed in this country. That's significant. The other large company, there's really just two of them, both of them control over 80% of the capacity in the country. Even more surprising, Cargill only operates two plants. So of that 40%, all of that beef is coming out of two plants, one in Alberta and one in Ontario. The one in Alberta processes 4,000 head of cattle a day. The one in Ontario, which is in Guelph, 1,500 head of cattle a day at that plant. Cargill has also recognized that in order to really be vertically integrated, they need to go behind the scenes of the beef. Well, cattle feed is a significant input into the production of beef. So sure enough, Cargill is a very significant producer of going into the feed, of course, are grains, corn and soy. Cargill happens to be one of the largest grain handlers. And then going into those crops is the breeding of the plants themselves, the careful breeding, the genetic engineering in some cases. And Cargill maintains a joint partnership with Monsanto, the largest seed company in the world, in a company known as Renison. And they're developing corn that is specifically designed for livestock production and biofuel production as well. And then there are the fertilizers that go into the growing of those plants. And that's marketed for Cargill through their Ag Horizons division. One of the main ingredients of fertilizer is natural gas. Cargill happens to be one of the largest traders of natural gas. And then there's salt. And Cargill happens to be the largest salt producer in the world. French fries. Most French fries, in fact, most foods deep fried are probably deep fried in canola oil, especially here in Canada. Cargill operates the largest canola oilseed crushing plant of its kind in Saskatchewan. And when that canola oil comes out the other end, they market it as Canola Harvest, a brand that you'll find on grocery store shelves as well. Tomato salad, most processed salad dressings contain canola oil now. As far as bread goes, grain handling, again, in this case wheat, through their Ag Horizons division. And if you can't finish all of this food at the restaurant, you'll likely be taking your food home in one of these new containers, which are made from corn plastics. And that's through Cargill's division, NatureWorks. So there's some more information on this company, and I really encourage you to check it out, because this is just an example of what this company is involved in Canada. If you went to all of the other websites of the various countries Cargill operates in, you'll see that they control whatever really the staple diet or the staple food in that country is. So in South America, for example, it's dairy. in Southeast Asia. It's palm oil. And this is just one sector, or many different sectors of the food system, but one company. And this type of concentration extends into every sector. So in the case of retail, for example, there's really only three main retailers out here in the Atlantic provinces. In Canada, there are about five retailers controlling 80% of all of the grocery retailing in this country. Food service, really two companies servicing restaurants, only a few servicing institutions. And so we need to ask ourselves, well, what are some of the risks associated with this high corporate concentration? Well, the first is price control. These companies have very strategically figured out how to get every last penny out of the food system. And at the end, or at the beginning of the day, where the food is beginning, it's the farmers who aren't really receiving much at all. There's a group called the National Farmers Union, which is a great organization that produces many different reports on some of these concerns around the price that farmers are receiving. And over the past 50 years, they produced a report that tracked how farm incomes have plummeted while corporate profits continue to increase. In 2004, as a great example, when the report was released, the average realized net farm income from the marketplace was negative 10,000 per farm. And at that same time, in that same year, 41 of Canada's largest corporations involved in agriculture or food production recorded record profits in that same year. So there's a lot of money in the food system, it's just the farmers who aren't receiving that money. Another good example that the National Farmers Union uses in some of their presentations, they'll put up a graph that shows a company, Agrium, which is a major fertilizer producer in Canada, and they show that when the price of wheat goes up, we might think that farmers are receiving more for their wheat because the price is going up. But when you look at what the inputs these farmers are required to use, when you look at the price of those inputs, well, they're going up just as the grain prices are going up. And looking at an Agrium price alongside the grain prices, you see that they go up exactly the same. So when the grain prices go up, farmers are not receiving any more. They're just paying more out of their pocket for expenses. Exploiting the global marketplace, this is an interesting one. This is a way in which our food system and all of those involved in the food system are able to access the cheapest product wherever in the world at any time because they are located throughout the planet. Some of the best examples that I've come across, I imagine most of you are familiar with the 100 Mile Diet, the book, the 100 Mile Diet. So I've recorded these authors speaking on a few occasions, and in one case, they're telling a story of a trip that they took to Ontario where they met a carrot farmer. And this carrot farmer told them that his carrots are not in the grocery store in his community. He'll walk into his grocery store and the carrots on the shelf are from North Carolina. His carrots get shipped to North Carolina. So as the authors of the 100 Mile Diet say in this recording, at some point on a highway between North Carolina and Ontario, there's two trucks passing each other, and they're waving at each other, and they're both carrying the carrots, one to North Carolina, one truck to Ontario. I wanted to find a good Nova Scotian example of this absurdity, because we could spend hours talking about some of these crazy examples of the seemingly inefficient food system that we have. In Nova Scotia, this province produces four times the amount of apples that are consumed here. Yet Nova Scotia imports 50% of all of the apples consumed here. Fewer options for retailers and food service. If you're a small-scale restaurant, small-scale retailer, you have very few options from where you can access food. Distortion of political systems. The larger a company gets, the more powerful their voice is in changing regulations that will suit their business, that their industry. This, we can see, has an impact on small-scale producers who are not in a position to really adhere to these types of regulations. 2 years ago in British Columbia, for example, most of our small-scale meat processors went out of business because they couldn't meet the new regulations that came into effect in October 2007. Certainly in my area, you cannot access local meat. Food safety. This was mentioned earlier. We know that last year, 22 people died from listeriosis contamination, all of this coming from one plant in Toronto. In every community I go into, typically the larger the community, this is more the case, it's the same restaurants, the same grocery stores, the same food on the grocery store shelves. There's quite a lack of individual food culture in these communities. And throughout most of the world, when I was living in France, for example, I could go 20 minutes down the road on my bicycle, come to another town, and their food and their diet is completely different from the other town. So we're losing individual culture. In order for these farmers and producers to kind of meet the needs of this industrial food system, the inevitable response is really get big or get out. One of the challenges of this is, well, for the most part, anyone growing up on a farm will likely not want to get into the business of farming because there's no money to be made. It's not really an attractive business or career to get into. For anyone wanting to get into farming who hasn't grown up on a farm and doesn't have access to land, well, trying to adhere to this capital-intensive style of farming is quite scary, to have to take out that kind of money in a loan or however that money can be accessed. So this leads to some concerns that we have now in Canada, where the average age of farmers is 52. Who's going to be taking over these farms? The Nova Scotia Federation of Agriculture put out a statistic that shows in Nova Scotia there's $1.5 billion worth of farm capital. And in 10 years, half of that capital, $750 million worth of capital, land, equipment, will have to somehow transfer hands because these farms or these farmers will be retiring. And two more risks here I'll put up. Void in the local economy. Every time we walk into these grocery stores and we spend $10 on our food, a significant portion of that $10 is leaving our community. It's likely leaving the province. It's likely leaving the country, maybe even the continent. And the last one I'll throw up here, lack of diversity. This is, to me, the most important one. If there's anything that we can learn from nature, is that diversity within nature equals resilience. We know that. That's nothing new. I believe it applies to everything else we do, our food systems, every type of system that we rely upon. As it applies to our food system, we clearly don't have a very diverse food system at all. And I believe this means that we don't have a very resilient food system. In our communities, we all eat. And so I believe, again, this is the title of the presentation, that we can't have resilient communities without being food secure.
Continuing past this topic of corporate control, John spoke about how environmentally conscious citizens are trying to change this trend in his native British Columbia. Listen on to hear about how cooperative stores producing local grain organically impacts the people in Nelson, British Columbia.
So shifting out of all this scary stuff, we can move into some of the responses that people are taking. And one of the challenges I've come across, especially now when this idea of purchasing local food certainly as one alternative is something that is certainly on the radar of everyone, is there is a lot of naysayers, a lot of people who oppose this idea. They would say it's too radical of an idea, it's too far out there. I often hear it's not realistic. And one thing I normally preface this presentation with, which I didn't, but I'll do it now, is I don't profess to have any answers to all of these challenges and all of these risks. Instead, what I would like to share now are some of the options and alternatives. Again, we have a very undiverse food system, so what do we need to create more diversity? Well, we need options. So it's not so much about whether or not the idea is realistic. In fact, I don't believe we will ever have a food system that's not experimental. Agriculture has always been experimental. It will always continue to be experimental. So this is my favorite quote that speaks to this. Do not fear to be eccentric in opinion, for every idea now accepted was once eccentric. So the examples I'm going to share with you right now, some of the projects that are happening that I've focused on my show in particular, are all happening for the most part in my area, in the West Kootenay region of British Columbia. I choose to just focus on my region because of the way in which all of these different projects are interacting with each other. And one of the reasons I settled in Nelson about 5 years ago is because of the way I saw these food projects interacting with each other. And I know there's, you know, I've been here now for 10 days in Nova Scotia and New Brunswick, and there are many exciting projects, businesses, farmers markets happening around here, and we can talk about those later. So this is a quick example of a quick image of where Nelson is. So you can see Nelson is pretty isolated. We're an 8-hour drive from Vancouver. We're about a 7-hour drive from Calgary. And we're off most of the major highways. And in order to get into Nelson, you have to go over these major passes through the mountains. We've had instances where for 3 days, food has been cut off from Nelson because of these passes. These are some images here. So that's Nelson there on the left. On the right is the Creston Valley, which is an area that is one of the most agriculturally rich areas near Nelson and has become kind of the breadbasket soon and starting to be of Nelson. That's about an hour and a half drive from Nelson. Nelson also has one of the highest concentrations of cooperatives per capita in the country. Cooperatives, again, seen as a model that is quite different from the conventional ways of doing business, and Nova Scotia being, of course, the birthplace of cooperatives in Canada. It's nice to be able to now come here and share that.
According to Steinman, the successes of the Kootenay Country Co-op store can be attributed to its strong support of growing emphasis on environmental accountability with food issues. Listen on as John describes the founding, growth, and diversification of this local enterprise.
This is the largest independent cooperative food store in the country, which is pretty surprising, right? 10,000 people in Nelson, yet here's the largest independent cooperative food store in the country. There are 140 independent cooperative food stores in the United States. There are only about five in Canada, so there's not much competition for that statistic. But it's not a chain, and that's one important piece there. It's not part of the Atlantic Co-op chain, or it's not part of federated co-ops like we have out west. It's an independent cooperative owned by members within the community. So it was founded 34 years ago as a buying club in a basement of someone's home. It was a group of people who got together and started purchasing food collectively and then distributing it out of a basement. It's now evolved into this store with 8,000 members. $9 million in revenues. Those revenues are going up every year. And the store doesn't carry any debt, which is also quite impressive. It employs 60 people in the community, so quite a significant employer in a community of 10,000 people. It provides the highest entry-level wage of any business in the community. Anyone who starts at the Kootenai Co-op is getting paid at least $13 an hour when they start. It has a buy local, buy organic first policy. If you walk into the store and are used to walking into, say, a Superstore or a Sobeys, you're probably not going to recognize any of the products on the shelf. A lot of them are local. And the products that are coming from afar are coming from more what we see as responsible businesses, socially and environmentally responsible businesses. And I'm on the board of directors because I've recognized that when we're responding to some of these challenges of our food system, that retail stores, grocery stores, can really be a substantial catalyst for change in a community. Certainly this store has already been a catalyst for change, but I think it can become even more of a catalyst for change. And that's why I spend so much time devoted to this business. Inside the store, just some pictures here, we have an incredibly large bulk section and an active campaign to encourage people to bring their own bags. Our eggs are sold in bulk from a local farmer. People bring in their own egg cartons. One of the interesting aspects of the store is the deli. So this is the area where people will come and buy prepared foods, either to eat right on the spot or to take with them. All of the food at the deli is prepared and produced locally, in Nelson or just outside of Nelson, by about 30, 35 different businesses who are supplying this deli. So what we see here is this store now becomes an incubator of small-scale businesses. One of the examples, for example, this is Toby Jenny. He's one of the suppliers. He has a small-scale bakery called Uphill Bakery, right around the corner actually from where I live. And he bakes bread in a commercial bakery that is in his home. And he bikes his bread down the street using this bike here and his trailer to all of his customers. In the winter, when he can't bike on the streets, he'll push that cart. It detaches and he can push the cart. One of the other suppliers is a single mother who every few days walks with a pull cart and her child with two big buckets of soup. And she supplies the co-op with soup.
One of the unique phenomena that has made Nelson, British Columbia, one of the leaders in addressing food issues is the founding of a local organic grain CSA. The first of its kind in the nation, the CSA has helped local farmers transition from conventional to organic agriculture, incubated small businesses in the community, and brought together people in a true group effort.
So the Kootenai Co-op is now a shareholder in the Kootenai Grain CSA. So CSA stands for Community Supported Agriculture. So this is an exciting project, and one that I've focused a lot of time on documenting the evolution of how it started to the point of where it is now. And the quick story of how it started is through another group I'm involved with in the community called Community Food Matters, a local food security group. And two summers ago, we launched an Eat Local Challenge. We launched an Eat Local Challenge that challenged the community to eat locally. Of the 150 some odd people that signed up and pledged to eat locally, one person pledged to eat locally for one day a week for 4 weeks. So it wasn't a big challenge, but certainly for most of us, that can be substantial. So he ate locally one day a week, and this was August, so it wasn't that hard. He was able to get fruit, vegetables, dairy. He was able to get meat at the time because those regulations I spoke of earlier didn't change, but he couldn't access any grain. Most of our grain in North America, or at least in Canada, is coming from the prairies. So he did what most people wouldn't do in this position. He went out and asked some farmers to grow him grain. He teamed up with a colleague of his in the Creston Valley, and they approached three farmers. And this is now explaining really what a CSA is. They asked these three farmers, what is it that you need to make a living farming grain on your property, on your land. And they came back with a price. And that became the price that was offered to members of the community. So in the first year, 180 members signed up. One business we wanted to test out, and I say we, because I'm also involved in this. One of the things I like to do with my show is get involved in the project that I'm covering. And we offered one business 20 shares to kind of get an idea as to whether businesses could be part of a model like this as well. Fast forwarding to this year, we now have 450 families who have invested in a share. Eight businesses have invested into 150 shares, not each, but a total of 150 among the eight. So to give you kind of a rundown here of what I spent, so I spent $125 on a share, and that's worth five different grains. So this year it was hard spring wheat, hard winter wheat, spelt, oats, and Khorasan wheat, which is a heritage variety that sometimes you'll find on the shelves marketed as Kamut, which is a trademark. So those are the five grains. And I had options for some extra shares, so I bought a share of Red Fife wheat, which is a heritage wheat variety that used to feed Canada between 1860 and 1900. So we're trying some different varieties too that are different from what's traditionally grown. And I also purchased a share of lentils. Last year, one of the farmers tested out a crop of lentils. This is the first time that lentils have ever been grown in the Creston Valley. So that's $125 for that share. Now, what makes a CSA substantially different from these other models that I was speaking of earlier is that in this case, the farmers received their money at the beginning of the season. Most of that money went into the farmer's pocket. Some of it went into the administrative costs of the CSA, which were pretty small. It's mostly volunteer driven at this point. But these farmers received the money at the beginning of the season when they need it most. So they didn't have to take that risk of hoping they'd have a good crop and hoping that they'll get a good price, and the price won't fluctuate a lot between when they plant and when they harvest. These farmers got the money at the beginning of the season. So that's substantially different from the CSA or from the conventional models. Another substantial difference is that last year, I can't use this year yet because I haven't received my grain. Last year when I received my grain, I didn't receive the 100 pounds that I was told I would likely receive. Instead, I received 81 pounds. Remember, this is the first year of this project. In some of the cases, this was the first time one farmer had ever grown organically. In another case, it was the first time this farmer had ever grown grain really for local consumption. So these farmers are trialing these grains. So I received only 81 pounds, but I didn't pay any less. And these farmers didn't receive any less. These farmers received the same amount of money they got at the beginning of the season. So in other words, all of the members of the CSA have shared in the risks of farming with the farmers. And this is all it took to start this project. And I like this image because this could be anywhere in Canada. This could be any community getting together to strategize around creating a new food system. Another substantial difference with CSAs is that linking between the farmer and the eaters. For the most part, this was the first time anyone had ever seen the grain that they were about to consume. It was the first time this farmer had ever met anyone who he was growing food for. And in this case, Roy Lawrence, he said in one of the recordings on the show that he was so afraid when he saw the parade of cars coming down the driveway that the first thing he wanted to do was just run when he saw these cars coming. And he was serious. But halfway through the tour, someone asked him, you know, how is this for you, like having all of these people here on your farm? And he said, you know, actually, I quite like it. So this is standing here in the field of Khorasan wheat. Roy is the conventional farmer who had wanted to transition to organic, and the CSA provided him an opportunity to do that in a secure way. It's not easy for a farmer who's farmed, in this case, he's a third generation farmer. We also celebrated the harvest of grain. We had an event here called the Kootenai Harvest Revival with music and sharing of food at the end of the first year's harvest. And then there was the transportation of the grain. So this is a satellite image of where Nelson is up there on the top left. If you look down at the bottom, roughly around the middle is a blue dot, that's Creston. And you can see both communities lie on the shores of Kootenai Lake. And so a good example of how some of these projects can incubate an economy and incubate other people getting involved in a food system was that through the media attention we received, especially from that Kootenai Harvest Revival, another group in the community who has no involvement whatsoever in the food system other than that they eat, decided that they wanted to support this project. And they were a group of sailors who thought, well, we have the knowledge of how to sail on this lake. We love sailing. How about we lend our time and knowledge to this project? So we sailed the grain. Not all of it. This came together in about a month. So we were able to sail about 5,000 pounds of the grain for Nelson members. Again, there were Creston members and Nelson members. So on the right there is an image down at Kuskanuk Harbor near Creston. So the farmers just went about 15, 20 kilometers up the road. And we loaded up these four boats. And this is no small lake. So this is a 3-day journey that we took. I recorded the whole On the left here is the unloading of the grain. And this was cool too, because there were 50 people that showed up, all volunteers, people of all ages, showing up to help unload the grain. It was, you know, this line, we were just passing the grain from person to person. Most of these people were members, right, coming to see their grain arrive on sail, on a sailboat. People of all ages again, these young girls were able to carry these 20-pound sacks of grain. The one, the young boy there below, he is having a little more trouble. And also, you can't really see in the picture here, but one of the local musicians was playing his banjo. He authored a song in honor of this project called Close to Home, and you can try to picture it. He's playing his banjo right now and singing his Close to Home song. Now this project is also incubating or also providing employment for other people too. Here we are receiving these whole grains. We have no idea how to use these grains for the most part. So we need to mill them into flour. So it's provided employment in Creston for a miller there who had already been milling grain, and now she's milling for members in Creston. In Nelson, a retired baker took his mill out of retirement. And so once a week, I'm able to walk down the street, a few blocks from my house, drop off a bucket of grain on his front porch. And at the end of the day, I can go and pick up my grain freshly milled. There's also the skills required to prepare these grains, bake bread. So two people, one person in Creston, one person in Nelson, are now offering workshops to all the members and the community on how to start a sourdough culture, how to sprout grain, and so on. Another interesting model that is also being applied here in Nova Scotia and New Brunswick are land trusts, land co-ops, and community farms. So I won't get into too much detail about these, but these are models that are allowing young farmers especially to access land without having to pay that really high price of land that is now valued for recreation or valued for residential development or commercial development. For the most part, the prices that land costs, especially near cities, is far beyond what a farmer could afford to have a business of farming and pay off that land. There's also other interesting marketing labels being launched in our area. This is Kootenai Mountain Grown that was launched last year. This was a group of certified organic farmers who started to become concerned at the way in which organic was becoming just as industrialized as the rest of the food system. So they wanted to differentiate themselves from the word organic, and they introduced Kootenai Mountain Grown as a way to do that. They're farming organically, and instead of having someone certify their farms, they're certifying each other. Organic certification can be a notable expense for most farmers. This is about half the price of certification for them. And they're taking control over that marketing too. One of the businesses who is using the Kootenai Mountain Grown label is this business here. So this is Mountain Valley Farm. And so this farmer wanted to keep some of his milk locally. So he constructed this cheese factory. Cost about $400,000 to do this. And there is so much demand now for local food that his first batch sold out within a few months. And he's now discussing with the other farmers, given how much demand there is for their product, on how they might build another processing facility to keep all the rest of that fluid milk in the community as well. So that's exciting. And so that down there is the date that I did an interview with the Harrises here. Urban agriculture is another up-and-coming way of producing food. So this is something that is, I talk with seed producers and I talk with businesses that sell seeds, and they're selling out like every few months during the peak season when seeds are being purchased. Beyond just growing our own food for our own consumption are these types of models here. I know there's a model here in Halifax that is trying to make a business out of farming within cities. So in this case, these are images from the first year of Nelson Urban Acres, which is a couple guys that started a business in Nelson, based on the spin model of farming. So this is a model that was started in Saskatchewan and Pennsylvania that creates a business plan that you can buy online for anyone who wants to farm within the city and make a living doing it. So their model is if you can access an acre of land within the city and you market it this way, you should be able to sustain yourself. And of course, there's a lot of other ways in which we're looking at urban agriculture sprout up, backyard chickens. I know there's a website here in Halifax for people to share backyards. So anyone looking for land can go onto a website and find people who have backyards that they're offering to garden, for other people to garden. School programs. I know there's a really innovative program not far from here where there's a school garden, and those students are going out and are very active in the garden, and they're bringing the food into the school and preparing that food with one of the more well-known chefs in Nova Scotia, Michael Howell. Those are just some of many, many examples that are happening in the Kootenai region. And I think the most important part that I've learned from all of these examples, from these grassroots examples that have really started from the ground up, they've started from just a group of people getting together, what I've learned is that we need to be able to really support projects that aren't necessarily coming from the top down, which is so often how we respond to a lot of these economic concerns, environmental concerns. We look to that high level of government, we look to the corporations to fix these problems. And as I've come to understand, that we need to be creating a whole new food system. We need to shift out of this paradigm of the food system we're in now and into another one. And so the quote I like is, to put the world in order, we must first put the nation in order. To put the nation in order, we must put the family in order. To put the family in order, we must cultivate our personal life. And to cultivate our personal life, we must first set our hearts right. So of course, here is Confucius saying, well, we need to just start from the beginning. And another quote I like, our own preservation relies on the preservation of community. So that wraps up the bulk of my presentation there. I've thrown up my website, and there's also some cards I know outside on one of the tables with my website on them. And I'd really encourage all of you to go and check out some of the shows here. This is a resource now of about 150 one-hour radio shows, as well as many other resources. And I'm hoping throughout, you know, your however many years you have left in Dalhousie, that you can use these as a resource for whatever subjects you're investigating and researching. I know other schools have used this as a resource, universities, colleges, high schools, and so all of them are there, free of charge. You don't have to pay for this media. So with that, I think I can invite Steve up to facilitate a discussion here, and I'll thank you for your attention.
La vía campesina. Propusimos la soberanía alimentaria como alternativa.
La Vía Campesina and the International Campesino and Family Farmer Movement, which included farmers from Africa, Asia, Europe, and all of America, since the summit in 1996, we have proposed food sovereignty as an alternative.
Also present at this talk were several organizations that work with food issues in Nova Scotia, including the Ecology Action Center's Food Action Committee, Slow Food Nova Scotia, Sustained Dal Food Committee, and the Granary Co-op. But my first interview was with one of the people behind Halifax Landshare, an exciting new project in urban agriculture.
So I'm standing here with Jen Stotland, who's probably the founding member of the Halifax Landshare.
A founding member
of the Halifax Landshare, along with a few other people in Halifax. And I was wondering if you could just give me, for the listeners on CKDU, a bit of background on what the Halifax Landshare is and how it works and how to access it.
Landshare is a project that is operating out of the Ecology Action Center, and we're also partnered with a group called SharingBackyards.com, which is international now, and we're sharing their mapping application. It's a website, and you can go to www.halifaxlandshare.ca, and there's a modified Google map on there, and you can put listings. It's a bit like Craigslist. It's anonymous, and you just put whether you're looking for a backyard to share or looking for other people to share a backyard with, or if you have land and you want to offer it and open it up to people. We like to say that it's a little bit like renting a room in your house. It's about that degree of safety where some people come to us and they're like, yeah, is this safe? But, you know, we engage in relations with people in the public every day. We let them into our house, we share property, and so we see this as being no different.
Great. And what kind of reaction have you gotten to the project over the last, it's been going for about a year now, right?
This is its first year, and we have 12 listings so far, so we're still ironing out the works, and we would like to really see a huge push this next spring when people are interested. But there are a lot of things that you can do in a garden right now. You can start to add things, compost to your soil, you can decide on your planting schedule, and meet people and start to put your garden together.
Great. Do you have any notable success stories so far or any interesting anecdotes you'd like to share?
Well, we got on the CBC not too long ago.
Oh, really?
So that was great.
Yeah.
And I've just been really impressed with the success of the Sharing Backyards project, which grew more than 400% this past year, mostly in the States because of the recession, and busted into New Zealand. They started in New Zealand.
Let's not forget Michelle Obama.
And Michelle Obama's terrific example. And got the whole of Los Angeles on board. So if you're in another city, you can check out the Sharing Backyards website, and there might be a similar website near you.
Great. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
For those seeking organic grains in Halifax, you may find some inspiration in like-minded people with the volunteer-run Granary Co-op, based out of Halifax's North End.
My name's Aaron, and I volunteer at the Granary Co-op.
Can you explain it for our listeners on CKDU?
Yeah, totally. It's a co-op. It's owned by its members, and its members are all volunteers. Mm-hmm. Basically, it's created as an alternative to make local and ethical food just cheaper and economically viable. So to be a member, you volunteer 6 hours a month, and then all members get discounts on all the food. You don't have to be a member to shop at the store, but you know, it does make it cheaper.
And how long has this project been going for?
Gosh, I haven't been involved with it that long. I think it was started maybe 10 to 13 years ago.
Okay.
Very much like the Kootenai store co-op, just in the basement of someone's house. And, you know, started with a very, like, activist edge, like bringing organic food to Halifax. And we hope to keep it that way.
Cool.
Yeah, to get involved, just stop by the store and, like, we'll put you up for a training shift. It's a lot of fun, you know, working at the market, selling grains, chatting, absorbing good market energy, and working the store, you're just bagging grains with other people and talking about local food.
Cool. Thanks very much for speaking with me.
Thank you.
Finally, for members of the Dalhousie community, Sustain Dial is working on these very issues on campus, and Kaylee was able to tell me a bit about their work and some of their recent successes.
Okay, my name is Kaylee, and I am part of Sustain Dial Food Committee. We do several things on campus. We run education and awareness campaigns on things like local food and a lot of the issues that John Steinman talked about tonight and how they affect us, especially at Dal. We also we talk with and negotiate with and lobby with the two corporations that provide food on campus. Those are Sodexo and Aramark. Sodexo provides the food in the Student Union building, and Aramark provides the food on every other academic building in campus, all the residents and other academic buildings. And basically, we try and push them to improve the sustainability of their operations. And we've had some successes on that front in terms of getting a discount for bringing reusable containers and starting to see them source more local food. However, there's still a long way to go in terms of them improving the sustainability of their operation. We also have an event called Tuppy Thursdays, where we provide a local and mostly organic meal every week to students on campus when they bring a reusable container. That actually happens in the McCain building at 11 o'clock. And the reason that event was started was to provide an alternative to the corporations on campus that were providing food that isn't sustainable. So basically this is an option that's grassroots, student-run, very sustainable. The food is donated actually right now from homegrown organic, and any donations we get goes right back into buying new food that's used in the next week's meal.
I hope you enjoyed listening to John Steinman, host of Deconstructing Dinner, speak about food issues, and I hope that hearing about the many initiatives happening in our local community has inspired you to find new ways to eat sustainably. For Operation Wake Up, I'm Jesse McNichol. Talk to you next time.
With science at his service and the greatest food-producing country in the world backing him up, the American soldier, no matter where he may be, can rightly consider himself the best-fed soldier in the world. And in the future, the war-born knowledge that has made him so, when spread over the world, can guarantee that no one on earth need suffer from malnutrition or from hunger.